This is Mitchell Katz, and you are listening to the Autism Experiences Podcast on Spotify. Welcome in to the Autism Experiences Podcast. My name is Mitchell Katz. I'm your host.
Our guest today is Noah Paulinger, and he has been working in the special needs world for 25 plus years and has his own set of learning challenges. He is also expanding his work into the trauma-informed spaces. Noah is a Hasidic Jewish grateful dad of five and a husband to the most remarkable woman / special educator alive today. And he is a big fan of amazing music and opportunities to bring people together for positive experiences.
So Noah, please tell our listeners more about yourself. What are your passions in life? What projects are you working on? Things like that.
Okay. Well, first of all, thanks so much for having me. It's an honor and a pleasure to see, first of all, this podcast is so needed in the world, and it's so awesome that you're doing it. I'm really, really impressed and proud of you for doing this. I guess a little nutshell about me. I'm a 41-year-old grateful dad of five, husband of the most amazing woman on the planet. I'm a Hasidic Jewish man that has been working in the special needs space for 25 plus years, and now working to expand the role, what I do and who we engage. My life was always rooted in summer camping and trying to create opportunities for people to achieve and grow and overcome their limitations on some level, and to make the world a better place. That's really what it comes down to.
That's great. Obviously I have a connection to that as well, being on the spectrum and being with a disability. So that obviously that I'm grateful for you to be able to not only do that kind of work and help our community, but also help people like me and people that I care about, I've always found you to be the sweetest kind, and we'll talk more, we'll give each other pats on the back, all day, but the sweetest, kindest guy that I've ever come across, who always wanted, to help people in good faith. And obviously people like me appreciate someone in their world like that.
Well, so, Mitchell, we're all walking mirrors. So the good you see in another person is a reflection of the good that exists in you. So I'm just going to reflect that, because everything you said about me, I don't deserve it, but I see every ounce of that in you. And it's a tremendous, it's a big merit to me to be able to join you on your podcast. I'm really excited about this.
Well, speaking of that, I did want to say that for those who don't know, you were actually the person who originally gave me the idea to start this podcast. Before we get into some questions about you and your projects and things that you're working on, and music, of course, wanted to know how have I done so far with the podcast? What are your thoughts,
amazing.
Critiques?
Amazing. Yeah. Absolutely incredible. It's interesting because, so one of the things that I've been encouraging other people, in our space, and I say our space because I also have significant learning challenges and learning differences, and I'm also hearing impaired. But I've been encouraging as a lot of people in our space and friends of in our spaces to really start taking advantage of what happened in the past year to the world to use their voice, because I think we're in a very unique space right now. The pandemic did something to the world that was, as weird as it's going to sound, was really a gift to the special needs community, to the mental health community, to trauma-informed community, the sense that first of all, everyone can finally relate to the level of isolation many of us have felt at some point in time. And now I feel like it's not just because their empathy is heightened, it's really that their ears are open now, that they're open to perspectives more so, even though there's this tendency that people are looking at the world as it's so polarized and no one's talking anymore about difficult topics. At the same time, it's an opportunity where when difficult topics are presented, it actually, you know, people like jump on the bandwagon. Even if it becomes a polarized thing, they're listening. They may not be able to have the conversation, but there's a listening element, A, and B, because of those tensions, we see that, you know, there's this, with all the protests and all these different things that are going on and sprouting up, the underlying current is that people are communicating in their own unique way, that they're not okay with the status quo. And I don't think we as a special needs community and have ever really been okay with the status quo, but we've never done a good enough job advocating for that. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. So I think that I'm in agreement with you. Yeah,
I think that a podcast like this that shows that, wait a second, first of all, we need to start talking, and we need to focus on what the stuff that you've been focusing on, Mitchell, is just profound. It's revolutionary, to be honest. It's really revolutionary.
Thank you. I'll say this, and I may have said it in an earlier episode, but there's definitely, like you said, there's a, you know, I call it a stigma in the special needs community, in the field where, like, let's somebody is on the spectrum, and there's all these programs in place for somebody that might be a child on the spectrum, but then you come to, like, where that child becomes an adult, and there's very little in place to help support them. Right. I've been lucky to have supports that I've been able to find to make it work. But even still, there's some caveats, like via insurance. Like insurance for somebody who has SSDI, let's say, like me, I'm choosing myself as an example. The structure isn't in place for someone with SSDI and Medicare, let's say they have a medical condition as well, aside from autism, is able to also want to hold a job. Right. So those people are left like wondering, like, can I work? Am I able to work? If I work, will I lose my benefits? You know, it's a backwards way of doing things, because it almost like incentivizes people to not want to work.
So I think you touched on two very important points, and these are things that I've been focusing on with a lot of people lately as well. Is a narrative element. And the second thing really comes down to ability focus versus disability focus. So I'll address the narrative element first. Unfortunately, the narrative and the stigma has really cursed this side of society so much, because whether we want to believe it or not, people have bought into the stigmas of being stuck in a disability focused world, meaning my view of the way people are, like, we're in the Jewish community, and I'm going to throw us under the bus, because I think that the Jewish community has unfortunately bought into an ideal about inclusion that it's really meant to be about, we need to build things around the things that someone can't do. So they're nice. It's nice. Like, we're going to build, ramps for people to be able to have more access to coming into synagogues, or ADA compliant bathrooms and stuff. Those are awesome. That's great. That's beautiful. But along those lines, are you also providing opportunities for them to show what they can do? Or providing platforms to strengthen abilities and focus on what people bring to the table, their unique contribution as an individual to the general collective. And when you don't do that, when you don't provide those platforms that focus on this is what someone can do and what they're able to do, and elevate those abilities and strengthen them, then what you're basically doing is pigeonholing them into buying into the narrative that no, we're always going to be the receiver. We're always going to be, looked at through the lens of kindness, but in a pity way, versus justice, meaning I'm given opportunities to show what I can do and have purpose, and I'm a contributor. I have the potential to be a leader. And that paradigm has to shift. I've been fighting this fight for a long time, and I have no shame in it. That, like, I don't mind picking a fight with hardcore inclusionists about it, because I think they just, I'm sick of the condescending outlook, to be honest, because like you said, people buy into it at a certain point, and then they wonder, like, is it worth it to even try? Maybe I should just sit back and collect my benefits. And then what does that say about human dignity? What does it say about our purpose as an individual in the world? And yeah, that's a path of least resistance, but it's not at the end of the day. It's the long, short path, not the short, long path. And I think that when people put in the effort to give people opportunity, that's focused on what can you do? It's so important. And I'll finish this point with a really good book recommendation. It's called The Power of Difference, The Link Between Disorder and Genius. And the woman who wrote it is the head of the psychology department at Columbia University, Gail Saltz. And the whole book, it's so amazing, because what it does is it focuses on, it talks about every kind of disability or disorder under the sun. And she defines what it is and what it looks like. But then she focuses on the things that most people don't, that within that realm, that population has an unparalleled genius that no one else has. So for instance, she says people with dyslexia. So you wouldn't necessarily want them to teach another person with the dyslexia how to read, but they have a level of empathy that no other population seems to have. So if you wanted to put them in a training module, what they do better than anyone is to go into the problem with the people who are trying to solve the problem and struggling with it. And they can experience the problem with them. And because they see things also on the periphery better than anyone, like for instance, if they were to look at a page of text, so they read along the periphery, but if they were to look at an architectural drawing and they're working on a project with people and they say, wait a second, zooming from the outside in, here's where your holes are. And here's how we can all work together to get out. And that's a quality that no one else has on their level. So she goes through all these different disorders, and it's very reassuring. Like when I picked up that book and I was reading, I number of times I teared up, because if someone finally started to focus in on, wow, like I also have things that I didn't know that this is something that I do, and I didn't realize no one else is able to do it. So if employers were able to look at people from that lens and say, okay, this person has autism, and they have an uncanny ability to see this where no one else is able to do that. Like the Israeli army started taking people with autism and channeling them into cybersecurity, the Air Force, like the major stuff that is like high level security clearance, because their ability to focus on those elements better than anyone else. I think these are gifts to the world that are being downplayed, and it's a challenge. It's a real problem. So I rambled enough for the past couple of minutes. I'm so sorry about
that. No, you're fine. You're fine.
That's an ADHD thing.
That's okay. That's okay. There's not enough words to express how much I agree with everything you just said. And I will send me that book, because I want to read it. I'm like, that's read my mind. Like everything I wanted to say about this, that was it. So I'll say this as an extension of that, and you may remember, you may not, but so just for our listeners, we had Noah and I, a relationship that we built. He worked or he ran a summer camp for Jewish people that were with special needs, some severe, some not as severe. And he said something to me, Noah, you said something to me that always has resonated with me during my time at the camp, which was every person, high functioning, low functioning, in the middle, wherever they are on a spectrum, wherever they are in their disability, whatever level they can be, can always be at a higher level than that, can rise above, you know, more or less. And that's always something that I've tried to, you know, not only, you know, something that resonated with me, but something that I live by. Like that's what I want to do. I always want to become better than myself. You know, that's just what I'm good at. And it's not as easy as obviously people just say, oh, I'm going to do better. Like, you know, like it's not as easy as that. But the fact that the awareness, step one, the awareness is there. And then step two, to be able to actually put some of it or all of it into action is really the key to unlocking for that individual, like their ability to, instead of, you know, taking a wheelchair up a ramp, to maybe start walking up those stairs, you know? And so that's something that I've always, not only like at that moment, you know, there was such an eye opener, even though, you know, there's been my trials and tribulations through life, that summer camp and those things that you were saying to me and things I experienced at the summer camp were such an eye-opening experience. It was the camp, by the way, for our listeners, was Camp Living Wonders. And it was just, for me, it was an eye-opening experience because, like, I would sit in a room where I was, like, watching the door so kids wouldn't run out or whatever, and just making sure lunch or dinner was okay and controlled. And everybody was happy. And there was moments where I'd say, like, over there was when I was 5 and that group over there. And over there when I was 15, there's that part of my life in front of me, you know? And then at 20, there's my part of my life right in front of my face. And to see, like, just an eye, I don't know how to explain it. It just, like, it opened my mind, it opened my eyes to, like, okay, like, I've grown so much, and to continue to grow and live by that kind of, like, that saying, you know, you can always be better than yourself.
First of all, I want to thank you for sharing that, because first of all, you just blew my mind. Like, that the way that you were able to see through that paradigm, that I can actually envision that was where I was when I was 5, and that was where, and not many people I would imagine not many people that are neurotypical, quote unquote, ever are able to go into a place and say, I was just like that, you know.
And relate to it, right? And then that's not the only thing. Relate,
not only relate, but to learn. Like, I see, and to be able to say in real time, I see where I grew based on what I'm watching. And I think, you know, one of the things that I think that people really need to understand, like, so I'm what you call a Chabad Chassid, where a Chabad is a Hasidic sect in the Jewish world, and our leader, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, he was very adamant when it came to people who work with people with special needs, that if you don't believe, and I 1,000% subscribe to this, 1,000,000%, that if you don't believe that a person, you have to believe beyond a shadow of a doubt that a person has the capability to rise above their current level of limitations, you have no business working with them. You have no business, you know, being their educator or support, or even not to say that you don't have a business being their parent, because parents inherently, they struggle with, you know, a lot of these elements on their own level, because, you know, whether they had a previous vision of what they imagine their family construct to be like, and then something shifts or whatever. But that's something that we have to teach our kids from an early age, you know. Like, children are put into your life, or whatever, whoever comes into your life in whatever shape or form they come into it, it's a blessing. And that's, you know, that's by design. And a lot of parents don't understand that. So because they're caught up in their imagination or whatever. But going back to what you were saying, is that it's so critical that people understand that they can rise above their current level of limitations, even if it's a little tiny thing. We're not stuck where we are. And part of the reason the stigma exists is because people bought into the stigma. They bought into, that's the narrative. That's who this population is. It's almost like, you know, when someone teaches their kids that a stereotype, that they show them, like, for instance, I was talking to someone the other day, this Rabbi Shai Taub, he's a brilliant guy. So he was saying the Jewish community, like, there's a segment of the Jewish community who bought into all the jokes that came after the Holocaust to help us cope, meaning that we're victims, we complain, that's who we are, you know, we fetch. Like, we go into a restaurant and we always, you know, it's too cold, it's too hot, like all this thing, and which is something all Jewish comedians joke about. But there are people who have taught their kids that's who we are. So as a result, you know, the outcome is that those kids exist in that framework, that no, that's who we are, that's, we don't, we're always in that space, that we fetch, we complain, we're all this thing. But people who have intention and say, no, we are a people of purpose, that we've survived all these trials and tribulations. And not only do we survive it, we usually come out stronger afterwards. That's who we are. You don't see them being affected by the traumas or the trials and tribulations nearly as much as the people who bought into the victimhood. So the same with a stigma that's built around disability. The people who tend to be the most quote unquote disabled are the ones who bought into the fact that we have to be focused on our disability rather than our ability. And we have to, and we don't try to influence other people to be focused on our ability. It's okay if they focus on a disability. There has to be a nuanced conversation about that for the paradigm to shift. And it has to come from people like you and me.
Well, I like I said before, I completely agree with all that. I feel like it does have to come from people who are living it, who have to deal with it on a daily basis and cope with it or make it work for them in some way. I wanted to go back to something you mentioned. You mentioned that you mentioned quickly about trauma-informed populations. And I wanted you to tell me, you've obviously, you and I have spoken a little bit before this interview, and I wanted to know and let our viewers know exactly what you're doing as part of this initiative study to help that population, the trauma-informed type populations. Can you tell me and our viewers a little bit more about this initiative and what you're doing to study and help these kind of people?
Sure. So I was very blessed to be part of something called M-Squared, which is the Institute for Jewish Experiential Education. I did a whole year course with them on experiential education, but we recently received a grant that is helping us to establish myself and actually my mentor, who he himself has a daughter with Down syndrome, and I also have a child who has significant learning challenges. And so when we applied for this grant, it was interesting because he was mentoring me on a bunch of things. And what happened in the space of that year was that it really shook a lot of everyone in the cohort was like, at some point, because we did such deep value explorations, we were all shaken and questioning like what our purpose in the world is and what are we really in the space that we should be in. And there was a point where I was questioning, maybe it's time for me to exit this special needs space. I don't know if this is where I need to be anymore. I don't feel like I'm making the difference I need to make. And it was really taking a toll. And so I was doing a project at Children's Healthcare of Atlanta, in the pediatric ICU. And I just saw that people were falling apart, like parents who, the longer their kids were there, they were falling apart left and right. They weren't taking care of themselves. And I realized also that there are a lot of different populations that are affected in similar ways. And I drafted an initiative for them. It actually, the nursing research department adopted it and made it a research driven initiative, and it was published recently. So my name's in a medical journal now, which is crazy. I was like, look, Ma, you know, my name's in a medical journal. It was very funny, but I realized that I could expand this and unfold it and really put it into the Jewish community. So what we established is a think tank that's creating a framework that's going to be training trauma-informed populations to develop actual resilience skills through the lens of Jewish wisdom and experiential education. So meaning, just as the same as we develop life skills, like doing laundry or cooking a meal, et cetera, we also have to develop resilience skills to learn how to not only be there's, and it seems like the common thread that we've gotten from all the experts that we've been speaking to so far is that there's three phases of and resilience skill development. First of all, obviously you have to be prepared for any kind of crisis. And then the critical element is the separation from the preparation separation from the crisis to the reaction phase, and then the reactionary element. Now, how do we react to whatever happens? Now, I'll take a second to define trauma-informed. The first population they required us to engage happens to be families of kids with special needs. Now, why is it? Because like I was talking, like we mentioned before, a lot of families, because we, a lot of, and maybe it's a really an American societal thing, that a lot of parents don't instill in their children the idea that, you know, the way our like children come into our lives, you know, they all take different shapes and sizes and expressions, and it's all by design. So inevitably, if you think on those levels that it's by design and there's, and each person has purpose, then whether a child, you know, has any kind of disability or not, it's much easier to take the blow of what you don't expect in life when you have that mindset that there's purpose behind, you know, this, every person has purpose. But the people who, you know, like I was talking to a mother the other day who her child was diagnosed on the spectrum, and it was like, it was really heavy for her, because not because that she's worried about her child growing and leading a pretty independent life. That's something that was on her mind, but she felt a sense of guilt. Now, what was the guilt? It was, she said, I don't know if her challenges that she's going to have in life are because of me. And I said, well, do you think parents of neurotypical kids are, you know, like ever think about those things? Like if their challenges came about because of their parents? And she was like, well, it wasn't on my map, but now that it is, because there's a stigma. So part of the stigma thing is a big thing, but the trauma-informed populations that we're aiming to tackle are, you know, first and foremost, because that's family for us as a team. We want to create opportunities for parents to learn how to, you know, especially parents who have really challenging situations. Let's say there's a nonverbal child who's, you know, a runner, et cetera, or you know, we've all seen children who are a little more challenging. It's funny, because I was like, I have kids, my quote unquote neurotypical kids are way more challenging. You know, if one of them has a diaper explosion and then they start like running down the aisle of a grocery store, pushing stuff off the, you know, whatever it may be, like it doesn't have to be a special needs child. But we're also going to be engaging. We want to unfold the curricula and the framework that we create towards educators and clinicians, camp staff. We found out this year, I spoke to the head of the American Camping Association. He mentioned to me that camps have not been able to hold on to staff this year. They've been quitting left and right because the COVID just shell-shocked everyone to the point where the slightest stressful incident comes up with their campers, they just can't handle it, they go home. So we want to be able to do trainings for camp staff, and also eventually we want to work with college students and young professionals just in their overall resilience training, because young people have been really, really affected by the pandemic and everything, in the way that the isolation has done a lot. It's really warped people in a big way, and so we can, it's safe to say that everyone's been a little trauma informed now. So I've just rambled for a very long time, and I'm so sorry.
No, you're good. Don't this is episode's about learning about you. It's not, I mean, it's learning about me as well, but you know,
it's about who we want to help, you know.
Right. It's important information, Noah.
We'll be right back with more of our interview with Noah Paulinger on the Autism Experiences podcast. Stay tuned.
In another time, forgotten space, your eyes looked from your mother's face. Wildflower seed in the sandstone. May the four winds blow you safely home.
We'll get into some more back and forth fun questions now. Now that we've gotten a little, you know, our viewers or listeners have listened to hear a little bit more about you and what you're working on. So I was thinking about this when I was typing up some questions. I wanted to know, I don't want to know, I think our viewers or listeners want to know, how did we meet originally? And I know we've connected over music, and we can elaborate a little more about that as well, but how did we originally, was it through my dad? Was it through like the our synagogue Chabad of Cobb?
It was through your dad. Yeah, it was definitely through your dad. First of all, we went the first time you and your brother came to the synagogue. It was to bless people.
I
remember it was a Yom Tov, and you are a very privileged and an amazingly honored person because you come from the line of the high priest, and you have a responsibility on holidays to bless the Jewish people. And so your father introduced us, and I remember shortly after we became Facebook friends and everything, and I saw that you were like a big music head. It was awesome. I was like, oh my God, this guy knows music. But then I realized, oh, he gets that from his pops, because your dad is like, I could talk music with him.
The apple doesn't fall far from the tree, you know.
No, the apple
mention of music knowledge.
He did a great job. He got you into your Yankees, and he got you into your music and everything. So he did a great job. But also, one of the things that was just so moving to me was that he raised such a mensch. You know, like the way that you interacted with people, and I think that you're gifted with, is that when someone talks to you, you're all in. You're really, really like very inquisitive, and you take interest in other people. And I think that that's one of the things that I was blown away by. I still remember I told my wife, like, I met, you know, Barry Katz. He's such a mensch, and then after the fact, I remember your father mentioned to me, yeah, Mitchell, he's on the spectrum and everything, but he usually likes to let people know himself and everything. But I know it was a brief interaction that we first met. And I just thought it was such a breath of fresh air, because you were anti-stigma in the sense that when we started camp, for instance, one of the arguments that a lot of the inclusionist people in the community didn't like was, they were like, how dare you put like special needs kids all together in a camp? Like, they need to be in an inclusion setting. And they were like, so how's it going to work? Are you going to put the kids with autism in one cabin and the kids with Downs in another? And I was like, absolutely not. I said, think about it for a second. The kids with Downs, you know, they're stereotypically very engaging people. They love the social interaction. There's a tremendous amount of warmth when they're given that opportunity in the right construct. And a lot of people with autism, not all, are much more socially isolated. Like they're not as socially engaging. But when you put the two together, so one is able to sort of help calm one down, or in a way that they sort of give them a framework to be social, while the other one draws the person with autism out a little bit. It helps them feel more comfortable engaging at their pace. And we saw it. We saw the proof of it. And it was just so funny to me that because there are people who have these preconceived notions about it doesn't work when you put these like-minded people together. No, it does, because when they're learning social skill sets together, it was a beautiful proof. But I thought that you were such a great example of that, that like the stigmas don't work. You know, the stereotypes are not uniform. There's not a prototypical thing, like and especially with autism, there's a spectrum. It's called a spectrum for a reason. There's different points on it where, yeah,
it starts at one spot, it ends at another spot, and there's all this in the middle.
I don't know if there's an end to it. I think because everyone's so individualized, right. And everyone the expression of their autism is so different. And I think that for that reason also, inclusion is a spectrum that begins in one end and could be endless, that some people could totally do full inclusion. And some people, it's a death trap for them. It's actually counterproductive for them to be thrown into a mainstream setting. And it's okay to admit that. It's totally okay. But there are people who, because they're such social justice warriors, they'd rather force a round peg into a square hole, and it's dangerous. It's really dangerous.
It is. I agree. I wish there's like this ultimate solution sometimes to that stigma problem, you know, that we have in the special needs community and just, you know, in general in this country and otherwise. There's not an easy answer. That's kind of the long and short of it. You know, there's just not an easy answer.
Do you feel like more and more people are open to the conversation? Like when you...
No, not right now. I don't. There's a lot of people that aren't open to even learning about what, like before that, like learning about what a disability is, that are closed-minded to it, you know, or just don't know. And I feel like you have to get through that first with somebody, the knowledge of that, and knowing what it's like, the best of their ability of somebody with, you know, knowing what somebody with autism or disability lives with. And then you can talk about the stigmas of such things and what you can do to better the situation, but it's all based on that individual. It isn't like the stigma is across the all, like you said, all spectrums are everywhere, and stigmas are just are like feed into the spectrum. So if there's a spectrum that is yay long, you know, and there's so much in between and maybe endless, the stigma is going to be just as long or similar, you know, similar to that, and it's going to be hard to figure out, like, it's all based on that individual, how it works for that person. It isn't like it's an across the board type of thing where you can use that same formula for everybody, you know, to fix the issue. And it's an ongoing issue. It's endless, like you were saying. Yeah. You also mentioned camp, and we're doing really good on segues today, so that's good. But you mentioned camp, and I wanted you to tell our listeners a little bit more about Camp Living Wonders, where it stemmed from, where it's going, and just your passion for the outdoors as well, to learn, I guess, a little bit more about you on top of that.
Right. Well, so camp for me, like I really, really struggled academically my whole life. Just couldn't cope in the classroom nearly as well as my parents wanted me to, nearly as well as I wanted to.
As did I. Like I was the same way. Academically, put a standardized test in front of me, and I was not into it. Forget it.
I now I'm to the point where I laugh at the concept of standardized testing, and not in like I it's more of a coping mechanism for the horror that I felt every time I saw one, but also I still remember when I was in second grade or third grade. I had a teacher that literally put me behind a cardboard box. Like I had to sit at a desk behind a cardboard box because of my lack of focus and everything like that. And I was the only kid in class like that. And they said, and the consolation that they said to my parents and to me was, well, it's okay because you're still part of the class. I'm not part of the class. I'm behind this cardboard box, like sitting in another part of the room. Everyone else's desks are joined and facing each other. Like that, I mean, talk about like a relatively traumatic kind of thing.
And a pigeonholing of who you were.
It was insane. So, and then of course, you know, jumping into the medical, the having to take the, you know, meds and stuff throughout time. It was horrible. So when I finally went to summer camp, And even though day camp was awesome too, but what clicked for me at a very young age was that the learning, the way that you learn in summer camp is all experiential. It's all hands-on. It's you're living the lesson rather than just someone standing at a chalkboard and telling it to you. And particularly from a Jewish realm, I never appreciated that someone's just telling me what Judaism is. I want to live it. I want to experience it.
It's like more hands-on, right?
One of the things that I love about Jewish practice is that it's so experiential. There, like almost every holiday has something that's sensory to it, something that you can actually experience, and there's a value that you can plug into practical life.
Right.
And so for me, the greatest learning that I ever experienced throughout life was at camp. When I would learn a skill or learn something, it was the one place where I could turn around and probably teach it better than the teacher taught it to me, better than the counselor, whomever was the specialist I was teaching it. And And it really gave me a framework of what, you know, first of all, I just, it ignited in me, like I finally know what I want to do with my life. But I also recognized that it was one of the most impactful places where kids are able to come into their own, to experience a level of independence, a level of achievement that they don't get anywhere else. But it's, but the, like the Rebbe used to always talk about camp in the sense that it's so beyond powerful, because here you have a bubble that is a safe haven where a child is surrounded by the same set of peers, the same set of values, and for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for a certain amount of time. And because of that, and it's a place that's that cultivates a sense of achievement and pride in who they are, all these things in a short amount of time, but the growth is like exponentially stronger than any other time during the year. Mom and dad aren't there to help you solve problems. You have to rely on yourself and with your peers to get through the problems together. You learn collaboration, you learn independence, how to put your clothes away and fold your stuff and keep track of your own things. And you learn how to, you learn these independent skills that, like, when you finally get to the stages of life where you're supposed to be more independent, you've already built up so much of it subconsciously, and it was in a fun way, in a fun environment. So, so having worked at other summer camps and different kinds of experiences through time, I realized that there, you know, even when I was working in more of the inclusion settings, I realized there needed to be a place that was just really built around and designed for the development of this population. Because I saw that other camps were kicking a lot of them out. You'll never hear about it. Like, it's not like camps will publicize, oh, this year we sent 7 campers home because we weren't prepared for their needs. And obviously that's the hardest thing in the world. But I realized there needed to be a place where those kids who were getting sent home from camp, we were able to look at it, train the staff around each one of them and their particular needs, and to be able to say, okay, this is where they're at. These are the goals that we have for this summer for this child. And we're going to celebrate the micro wins on a macro level. And we're going to give them the time of their life, or that's the goal, is to give them the time of their life in a safe environment. Now, the challenge is that this population is a challenging population topically. And, you know, if you're going to look at it from the lens of every other camp professional and everything, but A, no one else is doing this for them. That's not necessarily enough of a reason. It is a reason, but it's not enough of a reason. But it's also it's so critical for them to have that opportunity for themselves, but also for their parents. Like, you know, I can't tell you the number of parents who were literally on the verge of divorce are like, just they, you know, one parent, it was so funny. I said, okay, so just so you know, one, while your kid's at camp, like, you know, if you're going to be on vacation, you're going on a trip, just make sure that you let us know, you know, how to get a hold of you and everything, just so we can keep you updated on things. And they're like, wait, I can go on a trip? And I was like, yeah, you and your husband should take advantage. Like, this is time for you guys to like work on yourselves to, and they were just like, and she started crying because they never thought that they would have that opportunity. And like, since their child was born and since they, you know, got their diagnoses and everything, that we would never thought we'd have an opportunity to go on a vacation together and to have time beyond just going to the grocery store. And there was another parent who I remember, they told us before camp, so our son doesn't know it, but like after we drop him off the next day, we're actually signing our divorce papers. And I said, okay, first of all, no, I'm not going to take your son if that's the case. Like, he should not come home to a broken situation. Like, if anything, would you mind just pushing it off a week and just going on a trip, like, do a 3-day trip or whatever, you know? And I'll never forget that summer, the mother told us afterwards it saved their marriage. It literally saved their marriage. They never had that time to actually work on just them. And that's also a sign of the trauma-informed situation, is that parents who don't, people in general don't realize that how important it is. If you don't take care of yourself, you can't take care of other people. And so there's a lot of different reasons why our camp was born, so to speak, and why we want to work on it. But now, post pandemic, we realize that the main way forward, the real way we can go forward with it, is if it's family camp, as the whole family can come. And we can provide, you know, during the day, there will be opportunities for the kids to have programming, the parents have programming just for them. Sometimes, some of the time will be spent all together at activities, but we want to be able to provide them an opportunity to connect with other families. Because one of the things that's very typical is that we don't have opportunities to connect with other families in the same boat as us. And
because there's no time and
yeah. When you get a chance to like lean on each other and say, oh my God, like, I know exactly what you're going through. And, oh man, I'm right here with you kind of thing. Right.
Well, that's hugely important for families, is to be able to connect with
right.
like-minded, you know, families, you know, similar to what they're going through.
The community is so critical for resilience.
Right. So. It's huge. That's a great like direction. I think even based on what you just said, that families were able to take a trip and it saved someone's marriage, you know, and testament to that really is more of a testament to you to say, well, no, I'm not going to take your kid if that's what's happening. Then it's not, you know, this isn't going to work. And for you to step in and be like, go do something and put it off a week and see how you feel, you know? That's a testament to your character, I feel, that you got involved in this situation.
What is it saying? Like, if we're going to send our kid to camp, only to come back to that kind of shattered situation. So no matter how much we build him up at camp and how, you know, really pump his confidence and everything, like, it's going to come crashing down. And then basically that's trauma that he's coming back to. And so it's a very difficult situation. And these are things that a lot of the community doesn't understand is actually going on for a lot of families. And there are some families who say, no, that those statistics are not actually true. They're like, families are actually quite strong. Yes, there's evidence for both ends. It's very interesting. But I think, you know, because the pandemic and we had to put things on pause in terms of camp, and a lot of campers still haven't, the families aren't sure about the vaccine and all these things, and they're, because of medications, all these different levels, we realized that the safest bet going forward and the most productive really is family camp. First of all, it's affordable. We know that the special needs family, most special needs families are tapped, you know, in terms of financial ability, unless they're people who have just tremendously beautiful corporate jobs or whatever it may be, that you know, a child with some challenges, whether it's medications, therapies, etc., a lot of extra costs. And so the idea of a family vacation is not always in the cards, but to create an affordable thing, they get to go to summer camp together and do summer camp, you know, and stay in a cabin and, you know, cheer at tables and like all those kinds of things, and you know, go canoeing and all these kinds of things, where they build confidence together, they connect, and the most important piece to camp is community. And community is critical in resilience building. If you don't have community, it's just so difficult. And also to make friendships, and these are all things that, you know, the benefits are tremendous, and it's affordable. You know,
that's huge.
Yeah, I, God willing, we'll be able to grow that out as well.
Yeah, that'd be great. So I have a couple more questions, and then we'll wrap up. I did want to ask you to tell our viewers a little bit more about your wonderful kids. I know that's a big part of your life, so I wanted you to elaborate a little bit about your kids.
I rambled too much so far. Now I'm going to get into my kids. You better tell me, okay, give me 30-second snippet on each one or something. I don't know. So we have five adorable wonder kids. Our oldest is, he's the quirkiest and most, and just brilliantly amazing and funny. He does have, so also some challenges, and we're still working through defining what they are. he's gifted in a lot of areas, like in the sense that from the time he was like 3 or 4 years old, he was reading like on a level that was 4 years a senior. Right now he's reading on probably an eighth or ninth grade level, and he's 10 years old. I mean, he reads novels, and we literally can't feed him enough books. Like, he'll finish massive books every day. Now, on the flip side, his executive function is very challenged. To get him to start and finish a task is, it's a challenge. I'll leave it at that. Unfortunately, for better or worse, I think he got that from me. I struggle tremendously with my ADHD and everything. And that's something that I've really had to work very hard on through the years, with tutors, with every kind of, you know, you name it. And create systems that work for myself, and we have to figure out systems that work for him. That's what it comes down to. But he's hilarious. He's brilliant. His memory is just insane. I think he borderline has a photographic memory. We realized that when he was about 5 or 6 years old, he picked up a joke book one time, and we had people over for Shabbat, and he had been reading this joke book, and he said at a Shabbat dinner, "Can I tell everyone a joke?" And we're like, "Yeah, of course, that'll be great." So he tells a joke, but it was a question joke with an answer, but he didn't give the pause between the joke and the answer to let people try to answer. He just went right into the answer. And so everyone at the table was like, "Oh, wait, so the way a joke works is you need to ask the question and let people try for the comedic effect to take place." And he just couldn't get it. So then I said, "Well, why don't you go on your stage," which is like a fireplace thing, and "if you want to try again." So he started just rattling off jokes. And we were sitting there for a few minutes and like watching this. And I realized, I'm like, "Wait a second, this is crazy. He's just going through jokes." I have a hard enough time remembering one joke, you know, but he was going through like 10 or 11. And I stood up and went to the other room to get the joke book. And I'm like, and as he's talking, I'm like flipping through the pages, and I catch up to where he is. I was like, "What is going on here?" So I was like, "Wait a second, what page are you on?" And he was like, "What?" I said, "Are you on page, like, you're on page, what joke is on page 33? And he said it. And I was completely freaked out. I looked at my wife and I was like, "Do you see what's going on?" And she also got it. But it was insane. Like, you know, and the struggle was, for instance, he had a teacher this year that was insanely frustrated. Every day he'd say, I give out a sheet. I literally walk the whole class through the answers to fill in the blanks, and he won't write a damn thing. He'll draw all over the page. He won't write anything down. And I said, "Have you asked him to draw what you're teaching and then explain it to you at the end of class or something?" He said, "No, that's not the task that I'm asking him to do." And so I said, "Okay, let me just try something. So I just send it home and tell him to keep it blank." And so I said, "All right, Izzy, look over this page and tell me when you're done. You have 2 minutes, just look over it." So he looked over it and I said, "Okay, now we're gonna start the recording on WhatsApp to your teacher." And I asked him the questions in order, and he answered the questions verbally, but in the intonation that his teacher said the answers during class, like exactly how his teacher answered them. So we sent it to his teacher, and his teacher calls me within 30 seconds. He's like, "Okay, that was just insane. Like, why can't he do that in class? Like, I don't understand what's going on. What's the disconnect?" And
it was because you've got to teach the way that he learns.
Right. So this is a big problem especially in the Jewish educational space, mm-hmm. is that people increasingly, kids are differential learners these days. It's uncanny, but statistically, it's becoming a bigger, bigger thing that more and more kids are differential learners. Like the experiential education conference I went to, on all the tables, they had fidgets and markers and like coloring sheets, because some people actually absorb information much more when they're distracted, quote unquote, than when they're just sitting there and they're supposed to absorb it. Like, that's how they absorb. This teacher wasn't getting that. My kid is actually picking up everything. He's hearing everything. He's absorbing it. It's his sponge. he just has an aversion to writing. And this guy could not get it. Like he never got my kid. And it's okay. Like, I mean, it was a very tough year, like for us emotionally and for him. I don't think it did much good for his confidence. And it also, we realized, oh my God, we really got to get to work on this stuff. So that's Izzy. Now, then our second oldest is a daughter, and she's just a brilliantly creative, artistic, warm, and just loving. And she actually, it's amazing to see her, how she works with her brother, how she interacts with other kids. We were, I mean, as you can imagine, in our family, we always really, really focus on teaching our kids from a very young age that there's no real differences. You know, and when you ability, disability, like focus on the neshama, the soul of the person, and you can never go wrong. And the first time we saw our daughter, that it clicked for our daughter, we were at a wedding in New York, and there was a little girl in a wheelchair at the wedding who, like, she, my daughter somehow picked up on the fact that this girl just desperately wanted to dance. Like, nobody was dancing, not even her mother was, like, you know. And there's a video that someone caught of my daughter holding this girl's hand and, like, and spinning her around and you know, with a wheelchair and dancing with her. And this girl had been sitting on the side the whole night, but my daughter, and my daughter was only 4 years old at the time. And so of course I was crying my eyes out from pride, but that's who she is. And I was, and I couldn't have been more proud. And then we have a really feisty, 5-year-old after her, and he is all energy these days. Then we have a 3-year-old who's, she's just like the warmest. She calls everyone's her friend. Oh, that's my cousin friend. That's my show friend. That's my, you know. And when she meets people, she runs out to them. She's like, "Hi, you're my friend." And now we're at the stage where we have to teach her that there are strangers, and we don't, you know, like the boundaries. And then we also have a baby who was born right before Passover on the Rebbe's birthday. So it's a very, very big, for me, there's no greater gift in life than having a child, having children and happy children and healthy children. It's just, like, I couldn't be more grateful, but thank God they take more after their mom and their beauty and their wisdom than me. So it's a good thing.
So I wanted to finish today's episode with any questions or stories you'd like to ask or tell about your relationship with me that we can kind of trade back and forth.
Well, I've always wanted, I mean, Mitchell, I think you just have such a powerful message, but I wonder, like, you know, what's the most important thing that you want the world to know? I mean, and what do you think the ways that practitioners, that that the community could do better in understanding, like, how to give more opportunity to yourself, to people in your shoes, to bolster the independence level, the employment opportunities, and really help people understand, you know, find a platform of, I guess, equal opportunity, so to speak.
Right. I would say kind of what we touched upon earlier was having people have at least the discussion about the sickness, not just in the Jewish community, but in any community, in any part of anything. You know, if there's a stigma, talk about it with somebody. And if it's an issue and it helps that person to at least just talk about it and figure out a way to make it better for that person, hopefully, that's kind of like the best thing you can do for that person. Even if it's that person themselves having that conversation, if they're able to, you know, to take the stigma out of a disability, for me, has always been like your big challenge. Seeing myself in other roles and other jobs where I've had that view, like bird's eye view of like the stigma in general in this community, like, it's so important to remove that, or at least just, like I said, like, just talk about it, have a conversation. Don't let it become this insurmountable thing that you never get to. Have that conversation with somebody, say, "Hey, how can we take that way that everybody thinks about how you learn or how you socialize out of it. And what can we do to better help you as an individual?
Right.
That's like, for me, that was the best thing I could have benefited from growing up. Like to go to a private school in Alpharetta that was learning disabled, you know, dubbed learning disabled type school, and to not know about like what a, like for instance, like a compass test or like a placement test for college, but to know, not know what that is.
Right.
Because I was never introduced to it or taught about it. And then right. like you said earlier about being pigeonholed, to be pigeonholed in that situation after not passing the test, because standardized testing I was terrible at, to then go and be in remedial classes in college where I didn't have the one-on-one help like I had in high school.
Right.
You know, or didn't have enough.
Was there ever a time that you felt like a level of success and like really like where you were just, you felt like, yeah, I'm thriving. This is where I need to be. And you really felt your sense of purpose and contribution, or like, is it like really a never ending quest?
So to answer your question, when a situation where I felt like I thrived, I mean, I thrive in certain situations where I know I can get the work that I enjoy done, you know, and I can do work that I do enjoy, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So like where I'm at now at JFNCS, I'm working in the marketing team. That's work that I never thought I would, you know, years ago, I never thought I'd be good at doing. And now that I'm doing it and it's like being churned out on the, you know, like here's something that, not to directly answer your question, but it does kind of answer it. I always thought coding was like above me, like way over my head. And as I am working at this job, our email system that we send our newsletters out is based on code. And so I've started to learn, which I never thought I could do, like how to write code. And it's always it was an interest of mine to learn.
Right.
And as I'm writing this HTML code for emails, like I'm like, yeah, like this is like so practical. And like I'm learning like the ins and outs of it and using it like as like learning lessons about how to be practical in everyday life. So it's not like it's just like benefiting me in the moment writing an email. Right. It's benefiting me outside of that realm as well.
But that seems like it's a now that you're engaging it.
Right.
If it had been introduced to you 10 years ago, would that have been?
I would not have caught on like I am now. I would not have been as open to catching on.
No, but would you have envisioned it as like a potential career path kind of thing?
No, I don't know if it's a career path. I think it's like an added skill to what I'm already on the path to doing, you know, or what the path that I'm already on.
Right.
Which is like to promote and market and engage with people. And like, I'm also learning about like the analytics side of things. It's a lot of technical stuff, but I enjoy that. And, you know, the thing that I always had issues with, which, you know, growing up as a kid, my parents always thought I'd be good at working at the Disney store because I am so engaging and like, you know, I love Disney. And so like, when I was a kid and even now, and to say like, I could work at a store of products that I like, as well as I can have a social interaction with people. Now as an adult, I almost like the behind the scenes, like the opposite. I find myself like in the behind the scenes, like, side of things, but still able to engage and connect and in a different way, you know. Sure. So if anything to answer your question, do I see myself in a certain time of life that where I thrive and I just feel like it's been like ever changing? Now is kind of that time, growing towards that time. And I'll also say, like, when I've been in positions where I get to see, like I said earlier, like bird's eye view of a certain area of interest or certain, you know, community of interest. I very much like, I get blown away. Like I'm like mentioning to you at the camp where I was blown away by seeing parts of my life in front of me. So there's been like times in life where like that has been the case where I've thrived in a situation because I found more about myself. I found myself in a better spot because I was in that situation. And sometimes it just happens organically and naturally. And it isn't like it's something that I fabricated, to make it work for me. Sometimes it just happens like learning code. Like it just kind of happened. And I never thought it would just happen. So like sometimes it's all about like the organic and natural side of things for me to really feel like I'm thriving.
That's awesome. So I hope you find increasingly like large amounts of places where you are thriving, because you're a gift to the community and your contribution is really, really important. I think JFNCS sees that. I see it. I know that like one of the struggles, and this is a whole different podcast, is there are people who just, the challenge of finding where they fit, where their contribution is best and especially where they can succeed with, given the tools and the right support, it's so hard. And it's not just relegated to the special needs world. Everyone goes through that.
Right.
But it just happens to be prevalent in the special needs world, because they have a stigma going against them already. Then on top of it, because the vast majority of employers don't know to focus on the ability of people. And this is a societal issue. It's a societal challenge. And right. And to be able to shift that paradigm requires an army. It requires it's more than a village. It's got to be a huge, more people have to be talking, more people have to be podcasting, more people have to be doing, everything that you're doing. So
I'll end on this note. I don't think you would have given me the idea initially to do this podcast if you didn't think I could obviously pull it off, number one. And if I didn't have the engagement and knowledge of how everything works as a whole to be able to talk about it in like a setting like this. I think you wouldn't have asked anybody. That's how I feel about it.
This podcast and everything, I think this touches on so many of your great skill sets that you've mastered. First of all, you're very socially engaging and you're inquisitive, which we spoke about before. Second of all, the technical skills are things that, you're a music guy, so you love the technical aspect of music too. And third of all, with the computer skill set that it requires, these are things that you picked up on like that. I mean, I tried to start a podcast a few months ago and I sucked at it because I can't, the editing part was where I got stuck and I'm like, I just can't do it,
Yeah.
And I still need to really, really work on it. But I think it's amazing that you're podcasting because it's a good fit for you. I mean, if radio were still a thing, I'd say that would have been a great place for you. But
yeah,
but
this I tried. Is awesome. Yeah.
I think you're doing a great job with this. I love this podcast and I can't wait to share it. I mean, I'm sorry that I spent so much time doing the talking.
No, I'm glad you did.
I have questions for you. So maybe your second,
we'll have to do part two
sometime.
For sure. And if you need help with the editing, let me know. I have your hookup. So no worries.
I'll be sending you some of that. But thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being on, Noah. This was awesome.
I love this. I love what you're doing with this. And I think you got, just so much potential and needs to be shared on not just the disability websites but other forums, but also I think employers need to start listening to this kind of stuff. What's really the undercurrent is that you can do so much, and you're like, you've got such a unique contribution to the world, and this is revolutionary stuff. So thank you.
Thank you, Noah. Thank you for being on.
Yeah,
and we'll hopefully have you on maybe for a part two.
Awesome.
Thanks,
awesome.
Noah.
Have a wonderful Shabbat. Take care.
You too. Thanks.
We hope you've enjoyed today's episode of the Autism Experiences podcast. We will see you next time.